I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host, Luke Jones, for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on The Times radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome to the Game podcast from The Times. I'm Natalie Sawyer.
And I'm Gregor Robertson. We're with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business.
Indeed, and joining us in the studio today, it is sports writer for The Times, Molly Hudson, and The Times' deputy sports editor, James Restall. Molly, James, hello. How are you both?
Not too bad, thank you.
Good. Nice to have you with us, James.
Yeah, very good to be here after a thrilling weekend of Premier League football.
Thrilling weekend. I have to say my weekend was quite uneventful. It was very chilled, which was quite nice. Gregor, how was your weekend?
My weekend was quite eventful.
Was it?
Yeah. Enjoyed the joys of British rail system on the way to Accrington and back. Lovely. And then Saturday night I had quite an eventful experience.
Go on.
I received a phone call from a close friend of mine about midnight on Saturday night. And his wife was very close to giving birth. So I had to rush round, and they have a three-year-old son who I had to look after in the while they went to the hospital. And when I arrived at the house, there were some pretty scary noises going on. And it was close, and I was hearing things like, "It's hard not to push, it's hard not to push."
Oh my goodness.
So we were getting very close. The taxi wasn't coming. Helped them downstairs into the taxi, and there's about a 4-minute drive to the hospital, and my friend rang me about an hour later saying that she had given birth in the foyer
of the hospital.
Of the hospital.
Wow. Oh my goodness.
With nothing to protect her modesty apart from kind of a security guard with a towel.
Oh.
So yeah, 4 minutes, a bit more delay from the taxi, and it could have been.
Well,
and the thing is, my friend, I said afterwards, very much like Tom of this parish, he has a squiffy disposition. Oh. So he told me there's no way he could have helped.
Oh, so you
his,
would
his
have
wife.
Had to.
Wow.
So I would have had to.
To help with the delivery
I would have been
of the baby. Oh my goodness.
Boy or a girl?
Boy.
Boy. They're going to call it Gregor?
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah, I said so.
So who you see, you made a successful career as a footballer, you're making it as a successful career as a journalist. You could add midwife
maybe,
to that
maybe
as well.
Next time.
That is fantastic. Now, coming up, we are going to talk showboating and discuss the curious case of Gareth Bale. But first, Jose bites back. Jose Mourinho has landed his first major blow as the Tottenham boss thanks to a hard-fought 2-0 victory over Manchester City in an incident-filled game in North London. We're going to get into the incidents shortly, but do we feel this could be the start of something special for Spurs under Mourinho, James?
It's a very positive result. What really struck me was the way Spurs, playing on the counter, broke with such pace and such speed. And they were a real threat going forwards. So I was looking at their average positions this morning. And a lot of teams, when they play against City, kind of sit really deep and don't really have too many players in the attacking half. City, Spurs had three forwards whose average position was in the City half. So that was really, really encouraging. But I do think they rode their luck a lot of the time. City have missed, particularly against Manchester United in the week. And then again on Sunday, they've just missed so many chances. And I think, on another day, City could have been home and dry quite early.
Yeah, it's sort of strange that they are missing these chances of late, Manchester City. So are we, in some ways, Gregor, making more of this result than we should be for Tottenham?
Yes and no. I mean, I think, look, there's no doubt that on another day, City could have been 3 or 4 up at half-time. 18 attempts to 3, I think. 67% possession. That's overall as well, and with 10 men for, what, 20 minutes plus. So yeah, I mean, I think City on another day, they would have won this game quite comfortably. But Spurs did show something, you know, especially kind of holding on towards the end. And I think there are a lot of positives to take. I think obviously debutant goal scorer. Mm-hmm. I think Tantanga looks like a heck of a defender. And Lo Celso's really, really kind of growing into that role in midfield. And Dombele, when he came on, he, lovely little shimmy and through ball for Son. I think there's a basis of a good midfield for the future there for Spurs. There are lots of questions about Mourinho's tactics and their efficacy. Look, this is in no way, shape or form a Mourinho masterclass, as some people have been saying. But there are some positives to take for Spurs.
Depends, does it not, if they can keep up a level of consistency that will see them pip Chelsea now. That's got to be the challenge. They're in touching distance now, aren't they? 4 points. You'd think, you know, this could either be a flash in the pan result or it could be the start of a run. And you'd hope now that's how they're going to be judged, isn't it?
Absolutely. And look, I just think that Spurs are going to be judged differently to other teams because of the way that Mourinho and Tottenham play now. It's changed so much. So if they're winning games, and it doesn't matter how they're winning them, like as we saw, the fans go home happy and Mourinho is the master. But if they start to trip up and because of the style of play, I think really we're going to hear moans and groans a little bit quicker than other places, such as Chelsea. They've been kind of a youthful sort of reinvention of the way they play this season there.
Before we get into those incidents then in the game that we want to talk about, Molly, our man James Gearbrand has come up with a great stat in the game today. Jose Mourinho has become the first manager to beat Pep Guardiola with 4 separate clubs. So that's Inter Milan, Real Madrid, Man United and Spurs. It's got a bit of a hex over Mr. Guardiola, it seems.
Yeah, I think he tried really hard to play it down on Friday at the press conference.
Did he?
Tried to sort of say that he remembers a lot more from Guardiola of when they were working together rather than when they've lined up against each other on the touchline. I don't think anyone really believed it. And I think the thing about Mourinho and that style of play, yes, they ran their luck yesterday. And, you know, as Gregor said, it probably wasn't a Mourinho masterclass or utterly dominant in the way that they can be often without much possession or many chances. It wasn't really like that. But it has that way of frustrating Guardiola's teams, I think. And there's not always a huge amount of chances. And when there isn't a huge amount of chances, that possession-based style that Guardiola likes to play, when it doesn't have anywhere to go, when it gets suffocated in that kind of style of play, it can be really frustrating. And I think that the thing that made me laugh yesterday was just Mourinho's whole mannerisms on the touchline.
Could we discuss that clip?
The demeanour.
when it was Lloris saved the penalty and he was chuckling back to the bench. Somebody informed them that it could perhaps have been a second yellow card. And he sprinted to the fourth official and remonstrating for a booking. He's still box office, you know, he's lost something of the old, you know, the young sort of whippersnapper Josie, but he's still box office at times.
He certainly has passion, let's say. Indeed. That. Okay, let's talk about some of the incidents then from the game. Raheem Sterling could have seen red for a tough tackle on Dele Alli in the first half with the score at 0-0. Mourinho wasn't amused, insisting when the VAR decides not to give a red card to Sterling, it was thinking about the globality of the game. They decided to go against the rules of the game to favour the spectacle. For the majority of the game, it was 11 versus 11, but it should have been 11 against 10 since that very, very nasty tackle from Sterling on Dele Alli. So do we agree with Mourinho? Should Sterling have been sent off, James?
I think he should. I've seen tackles not as severe as that punished with a red card. Mm-hmm. And when you're going over the when he was going over the top of the ball and catching a player on the ankle like that, to me that was reckless. And they're looking at the kind of danger element of a tackle as well when they're making these decisions, and I think that should have been a red, particularly if particularly given there was VAR. I'm amazed that if that's missed by the on-field referee or seen as a yellow card offence, that's not upgraded.
Well, yeah, VAR obviously would have checked it. Gregor, was it red for you?
I think it's one of these ones that's very marginal. And I'm going to say no. I know the word intentional is not supposed to be sort of having any coming into play in this sort of conversation, but I still think it has some merit because Raheem Sterling went to win the ball and the follow-through, yes, especially when you look at it and kind of the stills and the slow motion, I'm surprised that VAR didn't than decide it was a red card because it looks worse. But I don't think there was any intent, and I don't think, well, it was dangerous. I don't think it was quite worth a red card.
But this is the problem in itself. Both of you have come up with different ideas. It's subjective. Molly, you've seen some replays of that. The problem with replays is that they can be slowed down and they look a lot worse than sometimes in real time.
Yeah, I think Greg was right in the fact that maybe we're all sat here thinking whether it was or wasn't in real time, but then you look at the replay and you wonder how VAR watched that, clearly must have watched that, and decided that it wasn't a red card. And yes, obviously those replays make everything look worse, but we've seen them given this season. And for me, it falls into that category of that's a tackle that 10 years ago, 20 years ago, you could probably have made. And nowadays, you're going to get pulled up, particularly with VAR. So for me, when I saw the replay, I was really surprised that VAR hadn't upgraded it to a red.
Hmm. I'm amazed that Mike Dean wasn't asked to have a look at the monitor.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
now something
that is the kind of instance where that should happen. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think, you know, we're disagreeing on whether it should have been a yellow or a red.
So let
the man in the middle who's made the initial decision go and have a look. And if he sees it, okay, yeah, that slowed down, so it might come across as slightly more severe. But kind of having a more kind of measured time to think about it, look at it, consider it, then make a decision, I think everyone in the ground would be happier.
And it works both ways. If you saw it, Crystal Palace.
Yeah, exactly.
Sheffield United, when the red card was reduced to a yellow, he's making the decision. He was asked to go to the screen. Mm-hmm. I think everyone in the ground at home, everyone feels better if the referee, the man in the middle, is making that decision.
Well, another controversial moment saw City awarded a penalty for Sergio Aurier tripping Sergio Aguero in the box. Mike Dean initially waved away appeals at first before VAR stepped in to give the decision, but it came over 2 minutes of play later. This is the problem, isn't it? Play continued, and as I suggested there, play only came to a halt about 2 minutes later. And from people I've spoken to who are in the ground, they didn't even understand why play had been stopped at all with the ball still in play. Are we happy that the play can still continue and continue for that length of time before play can be halted?
I think these incidents always look really bad when play has to get pulled back. Mm. But there are probably countless incidents that are being checked in the background that don't ever lead to anything.
Yeah.
And play continues and it's all fine. And I think we'd be complaining far more about disruptions in the game if we were actually having to stop for each of these things. The thing that, you know, the big, and I know we'll come on to it, but the big thing would have been had Tottenham scored for that passage of play, then, you know, there would have been uproar in the stadium. Mm. Because it's reading people's reactions, a lot of people yesterday didn't necessarily see the Aurier tackle firsthand, and as play continued, I don't think there would have been some fans who weren't sure what the play was being brought back for. And with no proper communication on the screen, it doesn't say checking for penalty, potential foul, Aurier on Aguero. It doesn't give you the exact detail. So, you know, there's a lot of you having to put the jigsaw together in the stadium. So I think there's a communication problem, but that's a separate issue.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been very confusing for the fans in the stadium. But you've raised the issue of what would have happened if Tottenham had scored. Now, we know, of course, if they had and the play was then pulled back, their goal would have been disallowed. But could you imagine if that had actually happened, how Jose Mourinho would have reacted to that, Molly?
I think what I'm about to say is me sat here in a studio, not in a football ground, not with any allegiances to either team. Because for me, if there was a foul in the penalty area and the team have gone up the other end and scored and then it gets brought back, then that's the right decision because you would have given it as a penalty and you would never have been up the other end of the field to score. Mm. So all of that is irrelevant. However, if you're Mourinho, if you're a fan, you're going to be absolutely fuming that that's gone against you. And then, I mean, we'll probably still be sat here deciding whether the penalty was even a penalty anyway, and somebody might have different opinions on it. So I think, you know, what we have to kind of remember is the whole point of VAR is to get more decisions right, but there is always going to be a percentage of decisions that you don't agree with, whether they're right or wrong. So I don't think you're ever going to make anyone happy. everyone happy.
Has been very...
Or just anyone.
No,
anyone.
just one person would be nice. But that's it. I mean, you've been very rational there about the whole, if we're in the studio, we can talk about it sensibly. But if you're in the stands, if you're in the dugout, like Jose Mourinho was, and they had scored, there is no way he'd have been happy with that decision.
No. I mean, we saw how unhappy he was when he thought there should have been a second yellow card.
Yeah.
Look, I think the guys have said it all. I think when you saw it in real time, I didn't think it was a penalty at the time. And then you see the replay and, yes, it was a penalty. So ultimately, they got the right decision. You want them to make it quicker. That's the first thing to say. But they came to the right decision in the end. And I think, you know, how often is this going to happen? Mm. It might happen once a season. I mean, has this even happened yet? Has a team gone up the other end and scored?
No, not yet. Not yet.
There was almost the occasion between Liverpool and City.
Yeah.
With a penalty kick.
Yeah, there was, yeah. I mean,
so this is so very, very rare, but it's good to wonder what's going to... I'll enjoy it. I hope Mourinho's in one of the dugouts.
Well, I think my fundamental problem with it is the fact that this system is supposed to be rigorously tested.
Yeah.
It should be tested to a point where the average length of time to take decisions is, say, 1 minute or around that mark. And not unveil it until you get it to a position where it works as seamlessly as possible. Because at the moment, it still feels in some ways like we're testing it. And if this is something that's going to be used in probably one of the top leagues in world football, it has to be better than this.
Mm. Well, there was more confusion, of course, in the penalty area. Ilkay Gundogan became the latest Manchester City player to miss from the spot. His effort was saved by Hugo Lloris before the keeper then sent Raheem Sterling tumbling over on the follow-up. So should City have been awarded another penalty, this time for Lloris on Sterling, Gregor?
No.
No?
I think it looked... this is different. I think it looked at the time like it was a penalty. And then when you see it slow down, I think Lloris withdraws and Sterling is kind of ready to roll with the punches, as it were. And that doesn't really make it a dive per se, but... he went down. So I think it is one of those things, again, these are very marginal calls where it's not really a dive and it's not a penalty kick. So again, he came to the right decision in the end.
It's all subjective as well.
The bit that frustrates me is that Hugo Lloris was off his line when he saved the penalty, because I sat for a Women's World Cup where this was picked on and picked on and picked on to like millimetres, and countries literally went out of the World Cup for this.
Yeah.
And now the Premier League have decided they're not going to implement it. And then you see on Twitter the millions of screen grabs of people saying, oh, but his toe was off the line. Mm-hmm. So technically, the fact that he's gone to save that and that small margin is actually a huge margin, because that could be why he saved the penalty. So then if you're going to use VAR, use VAR. I don't get the picking and choosing what we're going to use it for.
Well, that's where half the problems have come from this season, the fact that the Premier League think we know how to work this better than everyone else.
Yeah.
And it's not proven to be the case.
Yes, and Gianni Infantino is not quite happy with the way the Premier League is implementing VAR. But the missed penalty for City now means they have failed to score four of their last six spot kicks, two from Gabriel Jesus, one each from Sterling and now Gundogan. Pep Guardiola has already said that their keeper, Edison, is their best taker in training. So, this is a bit controversial from producer Max. Is it time some teams bite the bullet and let their keepers take penalties? James?
Pep Guardiola's ideal team would be 11 midfielders. And Edison, I reckon, could do a shift in central midfield if he wanted to.
That's one way of getting on the
pitch.
Speed
the ball around,
and I I might be being a bit flippant here, but in all seriousness, if he is a good penalty taker, we've seen it before. Chilavert for Paraguay used to take the penalties and the free kicks as well, which are even more risky situations.
Yeah.
I remember him taking one at the 2002 World Cup. I don't think he actually scored from it, but he had a number of goals. Then there was, I think, Rogério Ceni, I think, in Brazil, who got 100 career goals from penalties and free kicks. There is precedent, and if he's good enough, why not? I mean, City can cope probably defensively if teams try and fast break. Why not? It'd be fun to see, wouldn't it?
I mean, it'd be fun to see, but it's a risk, Gregor. Would you be comfortable with your keeper taking a penalty?
I'd be nervous. I think, imagine the speed with which they'd be going for the tactical foul if he missed. City, they'd just be careering after
anyone. Deploy Fernandinho. Yeah.
I think it says more about the kind of quality of the penalty kick taken from the rest of the team. If you've not got a striker or a midfielder who can stick the ball in the back of the net from 12 yards.
When you played, were there any goalies good in training at Pens?
Yeah, and they're often, they strike the ball very well. And Ederson definitely comes into that category. When sometimes you see those views from behind the goal and you see him launch the ball out of field, it's like a golf shot. So, I mean, he can strike a ball.
It's interesting because England, Pickford took a pen in the Nations League, didn't he, against Switzerland? Yeah. And they said afterwards they have this batting order of 1 to 23 in the England squad, and Pickford's about 8 or 9. So if players are off the field or not in the team or whatever, you know, Pickford moves up and he's in that top five, and that's done through rigorous practicing and testing out. So, yeah.
I mean, I might get it for a shootout.
Oh yeah, yeah.
But for a one-off penalty in a game, I mean, if that keeper misses, the opposition, they could break very quickly and get down the other end, and we don't want to see another Steve Cook save. Molly.
Well, there we go. This just proves that outfield players can play in goal as well. Why even have a set goalkeeper?
Yeah.
We don't need that anymore.
That's it. You know, just pass on the gloves. Anyone can do it. Yeah. Everyone gets 5 minutes in goal. It's quite exciting. We've revolutionised football. Molly, well done. I like that. Okay. This is our first podcast since the January transfer window closed. And it's safe to say it didn't quite deliver the high-profile moves that it had promised. Edison Cavani didn't leave PSG for the Premier League. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang didn't leave Arsenal for Barcelona. And there was no fairy tale return to Tottenham for Gareth Bale. So why don't we discuss the Welshman and where his sort of future in football lies. Bale was linked with an exit from Real Madrid during the January transfer window, and his relationship with manager Zinedine Zidane is notoriously frosty. Tottenham have thought to have made a late attempt to sign the 30-year-old, but he was believed to be unwilling to take a cut on his £500,000 a week wages on his contract, which runs until the summer of 2022. Since leaving Spurs for Real in 2013 for a world record fee then of £85 million, Bale has won an incredible 4 Champions League titles, but is now out of favour and seemingly unloved under Zidane. Gregor, should Bale have done the decent thing and take a pay cut to play regular football?
Not if he didn't want to, and it turns out he doesn't want to. I think it's always very interesting in this situation where there's a presumption, an expectancy that a player should always, from the very moment he begins a football career to the very last, be striving to be the very best he can be, to write off huge sums of money to play football. He's played a lot of football. He's won a lot of trophies. I don't think he's probably going to, he's ticked just about every box, I think, in a football career. And there's a presumption that that is what footballers should do. And the reality is that a footballer's relationship with playing football is far more complex than that. I remember seeing the documentary State of Play on BT Sport with Michael Calvin, based on Michael Calvin's book, and he said in that there's times where he doesn't like football. And I've played with scores of players. Lots of times in my career where I didn't like football, and it becomes a job.
Mm.
And the moment you become a professional footballer, your relationship with football changes forever. So he's, 30? He's won 4 Champions Leagues, won almost single-handedly in a final, and now he's finding a football club, his employer, and their fans beating him down. So your instant reaction to that is, F you. I'll honour my contract, you'll honour it, and you'll pay me, and I'll leave on my own terms. So I think he's got every right to do that. Maybe his love for the game has waned a little bit. Maybe it's not. None of us really know. He's getting berated because he has a hobby and interest playing golf outside of football, which is healthy in my view.
Why is that healthy?
Well, should your entire life be revolving around one thing? Is that what happens when you sign a contract? You sign a contract and you're paid £500,000 a week, doesn't mean...
But I suppose some Real Madrid fans and maybe people within the club might say, if you're injured, should you really be out on the golf course? Should you not be working on your fitness?
If it turns out that playing golf would have any sort of negative impact on his recovery, then that's absolutely right. There's an argument to be made, but I don't think anyone has ever said that. It was put to Zidane, and he said that he needs to look after his body, and there was no more than that. He wasn't saying, yes, that was wrong. I just think it's a stick to beat him with. And I think, I still don't really see what he's done wrong. When he plays, he does his best. If somebody is sitting there and picking up £500,000 a week, which is an eye-watering figure, just saying it, and he's kind of throwing the towel in, I don't think he's throwing the towel in. I think if he's working hard in training and he's given an opportunity, he does his best, he's fulfilling the terms of his contract and his obligation. So I think, if anything, the club has disrespected him. You look at that team, honestly saying that Gareth Bale shouldn't be on the bench for Real Madrid. I mean, with the quality they have, even still, there's no doubt he should be in a Real Madrid squad. So that's a statement. The club has been more disrespectful to Gareth Bale than he has to the club.
Mm. I mean, it does seem as though that the relationship has broken down in some way that may be repairable, of course. Molly, can you have any sympathy for Real Madrid in that they may be paying somebody who, quite at present, isn't fulfilling their end of the bargain?
I think maybe you have to think about that when they start dishing out these big contracts. You know, he's got this contract now, and as Gregor said, he's more than entitled to work out the rest of it, just as you would in any other job. And I think for Bale, he's not playing a huge amount. He's publicly said he prefers golf to football, or at least football for Real Madrid. And he's still getting linked with deadline day deals for millions of pounds to come and play for Spurs. So that shows you what a great footballer he is, regardless of all of this other stuff. And, you know, I agree with Gregor. I think who wouldn't do that in his situation?
It's always thrown onto the player too about taking a wage cut. I mean, I think Real Madrid could probably subsidise a great portion of his salary and still save a lot of money, and Spurs or whoever could pay the rest. So, you know, a contract has two two ends of the deal to be upheld here. Mm. I don't see why the player should be the person who loses out.
He wants to win the Champions League. He wants to win La Liga, where they are in the driving seat. He wants to win the Copa del Rey, which they've been taking seriously this season. So he's not going to cut his nose off to spite his face, and not play Bale for the sake of it. I mean, if Bale is, you know, Bale will still have an important part to play at some point this season. So and Zidane, as Ian Hawkey writes in the game today, Zidane is a man who's prone to changing his mind on players, and I think it's not like Bale is in a different bracket to say James Rodriguez, who has completely flopped at Real Madrid, and I don't think the club quite know what to do with him. Bale is still
put him on the bench.
Well, they could do, but Bale still has so much more to offer. And I think, you know, if for as long as he's still at the club, you know, he's not down tools, as you said that earlier. He's not down tools. He's available for selection.
I just think the key thing out of this, though, is that expectancy. We all have an expectancy of a professional footballer, and it doesn't always. There's a very complex relationship with actually being a professional footballer. It's not the same as you or I being a supporter, and it kind of being a devotion. It's a job. That's the way it becomes, especially towards the end of a career. You love football, but there are moments that you hate, and this is a moment where he feels his love for the game is clearly waning a little bit.
Let's talk about another high-profile footballer. We cover all sorts of football stories here on the Game podcast, but have we heard of a player being booked for showboating before? Well, over the weekend, PSG star Neymar was booked following an outrageous piece of skill versus Montpellier. Now, Neymar's rainbow flick won a throw-in during the French champions' 5-0 victory, but it saw him confronted by the referee Jérôme Brossard over goading his opponents through showboating. As you can imagine, Neymar didn't take to that too kindly. He was then cautioned for dissent after a heated discussion, and he was not happy with the decision, to say the least. Should the referee have got involved in this one, Molly?
No, I think that's what's bizarre about the whole situation, that this whole story has come from Neymar getting booked. And obviously, I'm sure he said some not very nice things to the referee and probably deserved his booking. But it's all come from a really bizarre situation that shouldn't have ever existed, because he won a throw-in. he had like two or three players around him and he'd done this rainbow flick to get out of that situation. I mean, it wouldn't matter if he did it in the middle of the pitch and just did it for fun. It's a football pitch and you're entitled to do whatever you want on it.
Isn't that what we pay money to go and see? People do, you know, people love this sport because there are gifted individuals who can do crazy things with the football and get people out of their seat. I mean, if I go and watch PSG, that's the kind of thing I want to be able to see. It's an absolutely baffling thing. I mean, I remember when Cristiano Ronaldo came to the Premier League and everyone had a go at his stepovers. You know, it's okay. It might not always come off. It might be to the detriment of a move. But for me, you want people doing exciting, different, new things. That's why we love football.
Well, we do always talk about flair players. Was this in any way disrespectful, do you think, Gregor?
No, I don't. I think, look, it was a mental decision by the referee. I don't know what he was thinking there. And in my experience, the people who are going to feel disrespected are his teammates. If he does that, he goes out and plays like he's playing in the park, rather than doing the thing that's going to help them win the game most. It's different when it's 5-0. I would think that, from my experience, if one of my teammates was playing like it was kind of a game of five-a-side when we're trying to win a game, I would feel that would annoy me more than being the defender who was facing the Neymar who was trying to flick over my head. I mean, I would do my best to try and catch him and then kick him. And he wouldn't like that. And I wouldn't like the flick over my head. He wouldn't like being kicked. It's just, you know, you play the game within the boundaries as much as you can. And that's as you say, everyone wants to see the most skillful and talented players playing the game. But I was also, you were talking about the step over and stuff. I was reminded of when Steven Gerrard, I think it was in about 2017, when he was Liverpool youth team academy coach, and he came out saying that he saw kind of a showboating mentality in a lot of academy players at the moment. And he was kind of widely derided for that, and he was acting like he's a dinosaur. But I think that this is what I mean about, in as a footballer, you want the players to do the thing that they are best at to help the team to win. It's a team game. So the only time where you would feel that someone like Neymar or players who are kind of often termed a bit of a luxury are doing things that aren't ultimately helping the team to win. Well, that's when you would feel, well, you have a word. If I was, he was one of my teammates, you would let him know in no uncertain terms that he needs to do something else.
Well, I remember when during Mourinho's first spell at Chelsea, I think I remember some comments about Joe Cole and showboating and kind of wanting to kind of not curb that side of his game, but in the way you're saying, Gregor, about how if it's not to the benefit of the team and it's costing you a potential goal scoring opportunity, but at the same time you don't want to risk curbing that player's natural talent.
Of course, and there are not many players as technically gifted as Neymar, so I think Neymar is a bit of a one-off, and it's 5-0. It's just if he was to do something in a part of the pitch or something where you're not meant to, and he has history of that. He goes out and he plays. You get the impression he plays for himself a little bit more than the team, and that's the only thing that's a kind of nagging doubt.
Of course, we have seen showboating before throughout football. You mentioned the World Cup a little earlier on, Molly, the Women's World Cup. USA players were blasted by some quarters, let's say, for over-celebrating their record-breaking 13-0 win over Thailand. The victory, in which Alex Morgan scored 5, was, unsurprisingly, the biggest victory in World Cup history, men or women. With the contest already over, Morgan led a team celebration, including the substitutes dancing on the touchline, and Megan Rapinoe decided to sprint around the pitch, then do a dramatic slide after making it 9-0. At elite level, is there anything wrong with celebrating even when you are way out in front, Molly?
I think it depends on the circumstances. And I think that particular one, yes, it was a very uneven playing field from kickoff. The US women's national team have the most support out of any federation in the world. They have the best chance from when they're little girls to go and play women's football. And they have the best support, the resources and everything that goes with that. And Thailand is the exact opposite. They were one of the minnow nations in the tournament.
Sort of privately funded as well, right?
Yeah, they all have day jobs, and just a world away from everything that a player like Megan Rapinoe has. But at the same time, it wasn't the US's fault that they were playing Thailand. They just played what was in front of them, and they played a World Cup, and you know, we laugh about goal difference, but that could have been important later on in the competition, or later, because it was a group stage game. And I was speaking to Jill Ellis, the previous US Women's National Team manager that was on the touchline that day, and she said, actually, looking back over her career as manager, one of the proudest moments actually was in that game, watching a player that had come back from injury score a goal in that game. It didn't matter how far ahead they already were, for that player and their personal journey to score at a World Cup, it didn't matter who it was against, that was still such a special moment. Mm. Now, I think if it was 13-0 and it was a friendly, then I think that's a different circumstance, and I wouldn't feel as comfortable with it, particularly the celebration, if it was a friendly and there wasn't so much riding on it, and it wasn't, you know, literally a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. But I think also, like, the Thai goalkeeper, who was like 5'3" or something, was she was really happy. She came out and said afterwards that we wouldn't have wanted them to play any differently against us.
Mm.
They are so amazing, and they are so much better than us, but that's just the way it is, and we wouldn't have wanted them to, you know, to play a weakened team or anything like that.
And James, do you think that is down to the fact that maybe with the Thailand goalkeeper, she's looking at that as the ultimate respect?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it shows disrespect to not celebrate goals. I personally find it a bit annoying when I see a player not celebrate against a former club. I just think, live the moment, celebrate. You know, you've scored a goal for your team. It's different when it's against a former club, but in the case of USA Thailand, if you kind of just sort of, you know, give your teammate a pat on the back, a little bit of applause and whatever, you're basically saying, yeah, this is easy, this is a stroll in the park, this lot of rubbish. If you're going and doing, I mean, I loved the stage celebrations. I thought, it's the theatre of a World Cup. This is the biggest event on the world stage. Mark it, celebrate it, enjoy it, embrace it.
Well, that's it, Emma, with World Cup as we know it. Only comes around every 4 years. A player might not get the opportunity to score ever again. So I can totally sympathise with why the Team USA went to the lengths that they did. Gregor, have you ever, though, been told or been in a game where it's so one-sided that you've kind of, it's been suggested, maybe we need to go a bit easy on our opponents?
No. I don't think so. When I was a kid, you know, I used to win 30-0 and stuff. And
I wish.
But no, I mean, there's never games that, very rarely there are games that are that one-sided, only when you're talking about a team like Paris Saint-Germain, they're so dominant, or, you know, when there's such a disparity between resources and whatnot. So I think the guys are right. I think you would rather your opponents be sort of delighted and celebrating and doing their best. What's the alternative? They just kind of pass the ball around and you have to chase them around, and then, you know, I think the game is about striving to win by as many as you can.
What was your go-to celebration?
Well, there weren't many times I had to go to it. So.
Well, so you must have enjoyed
you must
the
have
moment
honed
then.
One.
Yeah, yeah, I jumped around like a kind of wild little Bambi or something, with loose limbs everywhere.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Now we end with a sad story from the Football League. The Accrington Stanley striker Billy Key has announced his retirement at the age of 29 due to ongoing mental health issues. Key, who hit 84 goals in 239 games in two spells, received a standing ovation at the Crown Ground before Stanley's 2-1 win over AFC Wimbledon this weekend, and the club have announced they will retire Key's shirt number of 29 in honour of the forward. He revealed in September that he had been receiving treatment for depression, anxiety and bulimia and had not played since last April. He scored 26 goals for the club in the 2017-18 League Two title winning season that saw Accrington promoted to the third tier for the first time. He said this on the club website: "The most important thing is my health and my family, and now I have made the decision, I feel in a better place. Accrington will always have a place in my heart, and I can never thank owner Andy Holt, manager John Coleman and assistant manager Jim Bell enough for everything they have done for me." Now, Gregor, I know you've covered this story for The Times. How brave has this decision been for Key, and how brave has it been for him to speak out as he has?
Very brave. I mean, I was at the game on Saturday. Really touching kind of little presentation before. They told all the fans to get in 20 minutes before and it was pretty much full. And he kind of was prayed to the fans and they all serenaded him and he was in tears. So he had a real affinity with that football club. He's a bit of a throwback. He says he likes to have a pint after the game. He likes to go out with his pals and have a kebab. he's not someone who's kind of the sports science side of the game and about being an athlete, that's not really being him. And he's still, I've played against him. He was a very good striker. But it's brave for two reasons. One, yeah, as you say, just speaking out. And he said if voicing his issues helps one person, then it'll have been worthwhile. But the second thing is, you know, people have spoken out about mental health struggles and struggles with depression, but actually taking the decision to step back and to retire from the game at the age of 29, when he was earning decent money, you know, this is Accrington Stanley, it's not Premier League money, and he's got children, and really the future is quite an unknown, is very brave. But he kind of, the way he explained it, he was saying that football is not the root cause of his struggles with mental health, but football is not good for his mental health. So, you know, these issues are part of him, but playing football made it much harder for him to live a kind of happy life. So I think the decision to step away was very brave. And he also said that he thinks there'd be more footballers than we could ever realise, really, who have similar issues with depression and anxiety, because football is so all-consuming. I mean, you think there'd be no correlation between what we're talking about with Gareth Bale and Billy Key there, but Gareth Bale is someone who is able to seemingly take a step back from all the noise and all the surrounding sort of issues with playing for Real Madrid and you know, getting abuse from his fans and the football club not wanting him and still step back and seemingly having a happy life. Billy Key could not, he was telling me he would read fans' forums to kind of, he was so stressed out about how he'd played. If he'd lost, he wouldn't sleep for days. If he missed a chance, he just couldn't quite find the kind of coping mechanisms to play football at a professional level. He wants to hopefully play at a part-time level where it's not about money and it's just all about the enjoyment, because he still said he knows he'll miss the 90 minutes. He hated training. He used to, apparently, if he ever asked to do an interview, he would hide. He would say yes, but only if it's like at 10 o'clock so I can miss training.
Really?
But when the Saturday came around, the 90 minutes of kind of release and having a scrap and the physicality of it, that's something that is very hard to replace. So I hope he does go and play somewhere.
Yeah, it's incredible, actually, when you hear more about what he's had to say. I mean, last year he spoke openly about his struggles. He said, "I would wake up every Saturday thinking, I hope the game's off. I hope it rains loads. I was rocking on the bed crying and I wasn't enjoying it. I wanted to quit. I was low at the time, and you start thinking, well, I just drive my car into a wall. I thought, that's it, that's me done. Why is someone with the best job in the world going to kill themselves? It just doesn't make sense." And I suppose the problem is we put football and footballers on a pedestal, like it is the dream job, if you like, James. But ultimately, it is a job and there is pressures that come with it. And unfortunately, for Key, he's had his struggles. But I suppose my point is that we do see it as this amazing position that these footballers are in, but they're just like everybody else.
I'd like to say Accrington Stanley and Billy Key deserve amazing credit for what they've done. Because you touched on it earlier, Gregor, but the number of people who will have been made aware of his story, it's educational, and it shows people who might be going through the same thing, not in football, but mm-hmm. in their own lines of work, in their own lives. And to see someone speaking so openly and candidly and honestly about what they're suffering is a real source of hope for someone. And I mean, I from a more personal point of view, as a Leighton Orient supporter, our director of football, Martin Ling, has spoken very openly about his battles with mental health, and football can use its platform. You know, you have an amazing platform in football, and people going through struggles with their health, if they can speak about these things openly, it can help thousands of people potentially.
Yeah, it certainly can. And obviously, in the women's game, there have been women footballers who have come out with their own struggles within the game, Molly.
Yeah, and I think maybe the women's game will perhaps isn't at this level at the moment where there has been such scrutiny, and particularly from the financial side of things, that hasn't been really a barrier that women's players have ever had to consider, because women's football has never really been full-time. And now that it is, I spoke to Beth Rowe, who plays for Brighton in the Women's Super League, and she's a professional footballer now, and she found it really difficult that football was all she had. And when she had mental health issues, she realised that she didn't have anything to step back away from, and she quit the game to find something else that she loved as well as football, so that she had something to go back to, and something that, you know, when she did get injured, it wasn't literally the end of the world. And she started a degree now, and has that to fall back on. So now when the football isn't going right, or when her mental health's worse, she has somewhere else to go, which, you know, as Gregor was saying with Gareth Bale and the golf, if he can be happy, then ultimately that's way more important than how many goals you're going to score in a season.
And of course we do send out our wishes to Billy Keane and wish him all the very best in whatever comes next for him. That is it for now. Many thanks to our guests today, James Restall and Molly Hudson.
Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online and on your smartphone or tablet.
It is just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information, and we'll be back on Thursday.